Welcome to another episode of Theatre Voice, the podcast that gets theatre makers talking. I'm Matt Truman. This week, the playwright Nina Rain. When it premiered at the National Theatre back in March, Nina Rain's new play Consent already seemed topical. 6 months on, as the fallout from Harvey Weinstein's systemic sexual harassment rolls on, it's starting to look prescient beyond all measure. Consent is a remarkable play in its own right, that rarest of beasts, a bona fide modern classic, up there, in my opinion, with Tom Stoppard's Arcadia and Michael Frayn's Copenhagen. Why? Because like them, Rain turns her play's perspective around and around to view both its subject and its situation from a number of different angles. It's philosophical, it's political, it's ethical, but most of all, it's human. Consent centres on the private lives of a group of London lawyers and a contentious rape case they're working on. When Kitty accuses her barrister husband Edward of marital rape, it leads to questions about the nature of consent and the possibility of judgment. I started by asking Nina Rain what inspired her to begin work on the play.
About because I'd been spending some time socially with some barristers, and I was fascinated that they do this thing where they talk about their clients in the first person. So they say, I murdered, I raped, and it's a shorthand between barristers, so they don't do it. If they were talking just to me, to a layperson, they wouldn't do it, but amongst themselves it's a shorthand. And I thought, wow, this would be a brilliant starting point for a play, because you'd have this audience watching these very middle-class people, and suddenly they'd startle us by saying that they had raped and murdered people. And I thought, and the thing is, we don't think middle-class people do those things, but they do. And so it would be great if they're just talking about them, and actually they're talking about their clients who they hold at arm's length, but by the end of the play they actually have possibly raped, possibly murdered. I wasn't sure then what they were going to do, but I wanted it to be Greek and intense, because the other thing that was in my head was, you know, those stories that you read in the Daily Mail about fathers in Tenerife jumping off balconies with their children because they are so angry with their ex-wife, and the way that we are, we think that, you know, Medea was sort of a special theatrical thing, but actually it happens in real life. So that was where I started off with the play.
So it starts from a point of performance, almost, in the real world. There's a moment later on when one of the characters, who's an actress, talks in the exact same way about a character that she's setting into play. I do this, I do that.
Yeah, yeah. So once you start, it's always the same when you're writing a play. You have this idea, and then examples sort of come to you like iron filings to a magnet, you know. So of course I know actors socially as well, and I was talking to Charlotte Randall, who's an actress, and she was saying, oh, I'm doing this play at the Court, and I do this and I do that, and I'm suicidal and this, that, the other. And I thought, oh, this is perfect, it's just like my barristers, you know. So that kind of drew itself to the play.
It builds to quite a complex consideration of law and the legal system. What were you actually chasing down in those terms?
I think I was discovering it as I went along, because I didn't go with any axe to grind. I just went and I watched various cases, and then I thought, oh, the law's really chaotic. It was all these things that I didn't expect. It's a bit like the NHS, it's improvised. It's, oh shit, we don't have that document, well, we won't be able to pursue that line of argument. Oh, what a shame. Oh well, you know. And that was quite astounding to me. And I only knew because, unlike the jury, I was sitting in the courtroom and I'd hear the legal arguments when the jury are sent out, where, you know, the two barristers pop up and say, please can I air this bit of evidence? Oh no, you're not. No, I decide not. And then the jury never hear that something incredibly relevant in my mind had happened. I was interested in how the law feels pretty unfair a lot of the time, which is the bizarre thing, that it's got to be so disinterested that things get excluded that you think, well, that's not fair. You know, if we knew that he was a violent man and all these things, then we would definitely be more suspicious of him. And of course, that's the point. You have to judge the person just on this one instance and not on their history. And then that got me to thinking about people's relationships and how they talk in law about your previous. And I was thinking, that's interesting, isn't it? If there was a husband who'd been very, very adulterous, and then in this instance, he's not. He's innocent. But we wouldn't use the same rules as the law. We'd judge him, and maybe that's the disaster, that the wife thinks he's cheating and he's not, you know, in this case.
So there's a real sort of sense of the law and morality,
yeah,
that just jostle against each other throughout the play.
Yeah, absolutely. And how moral or immoral is the law? That's the other thing. We think the law is immutable, but actually it's always being tweaked and changed. And something that was happening, I spoke to a human rights very grand QC, and he was in despair about the fact that there was this thing that he called victims' justice, that the victims' impact statement he disapproved of, because he felt that the law was sort of becoming all about making the victim feel okay, and actually that's not the job of the law. Because he said it becomes about vengeance at that point, and that's not what the law should be doing. So then that I started thinking about the characters, and this character of the wife, who's the, you know, along with the actress, she's the only person in the play who's not a barrister and the victim. And I thought, wouldn't it be interesting if there's someone who thinks that the law is punitive and unfair and rigid and inhumane and all those things, and then she actually becomes more rigid and punitive and inhumane than anyone else in the play. I thought that would be a brilliant reversal, and I set that up as a challenge character-wise. I thought, can you do that? Can I make her go from this position to that, you know, in the course of the play? Mm. So that was the umbrella sort of idea I had.
So at the centre of the play, there are these two cases revolving around sexual consent, two rape cases that reflect off each other in quite interesting ways.
I wanted to describe one that was absolutely black and white for me, and one that was as grey and as smudgy as possible. So the black and white one is the one that we see in court, and the grey smudgy one is the one that's marital. That's the other argument that gets aired, is, you know, can you have degrees of rape? And that's such an interesting question, isn't it? And I suppose I got interested in the way that life, especially when you're talking about a husband and wife, it's always two narratives, isn't it? And where is the truth? And I thought it'd be brilliant to have a rape where one person could say that wasn't a rape, and they're not lying. They genuinely believe it wasn't, and someone genuinely believes it was, the other person involved on that night. And then where is the truth, you know? And I thought, but it was so delicate to have to try and write that, because you don't want to belittle anyone's experience, and rape is an incredibly hot topic. So I had to be really delicate about it when I was trying to write it.
Especially, I suppose, when you start turning it into a kind of conundrum, an ethical conundrum, yeah, or a legal conundrum, that kind of case study quality. How difficult is it to kind of deal with subjects like that in quite a detached way as a writer?
It's really hard. It's hard in so many different ways, because when you're writing about something like that, I become so aware that there are people who have actually suffered this thing. So you can actually get all twisted up and think, is it immoral to be writing about it when, you know, I haven't suffered from it, and I'm just kind of making it up and having a fun time and writing a play. So you do get quite tangled up, actually. And that's partly why I went to lots of cases, because I thought, I want to actually really immerse myself in this and sort of see what it's all about. I hate the idea of writing something just from my own imagination, and, you know, there's something quite self-indulgent about that, I think.
Let's talk about the structure of the play, because that's one of the things that's so fascinating about it. It is a play that comes full circle, that begins and ends in the same point, but having gone through a lot. It's a play that puts the shoe on the other foot of pretty much every character, where cuckolds become cuckolded, judges get judged. How much planning went into this as a piece of writing? How much was it just about letting your fingers go on the keyboard?
Oh my God. Well, it took a long time, that's the thing. As I've endlessly said, it took years and years. And that wasn't just years sitting at the laptop, because I would have gone mad. It was years going off doing other jobs, coming back to it. And you have to slightly be led by your characters, but then also exert control over them. That's the thing. It's a mixture. And there were points at the in the writing of it where I thought, oh God, like, I remember there are moments in life really vivid, because you think, oh, I was there when I was writing that particular bit. So I remember when I was writing the scene where the lawyers sort of do that, I don't know what to call it, a kind of mating sort of struggle over the actress, and they are using techniques from the courtroom to expose each other and so on. I was in Chicago when I was writing that, because they were doing Tribes, the Steppenwolf company were doing Tribes, and I just remember thinking, I am never going to, how am I going to, is Jake in that scene? You know, is it Jake who's having the affair? It was so, you have to kind of keep going down blind alleys until you think, oh no, it's this character. And I remember my brother, who's also a playwright, Mo, reading it and saying, you've just got too many characters, Neans. You've got to, why have you got the Pip Carter character, you know, Matt? You could just make Jake perform all the functions of Matt. He could be the one having the affair with Kitty. And I thought, no, that it's almost like algebra. You try it for a bit and then you go, no, it can't be him because of X, Y, and Z. So, and I felt like I need to have two free agents. I need to have people in the play who are not married and not have kids. And one of them is this Matt, and one of them is Zara, the actress. And they will detonate. Something about them being free and single will detonate all these marriages. So I haven't really answered the question. It just took a long time and lots of false starts. And I wish I'd known that at the beginning, because you feel so lost at times. You think, I'll never be able to wrap this one up.
But it's an extraordinary thing, isn't it? Because that structure ends up revealing so much about the ideas, the sense of seeing something from two different sides, of there being two irreconcilable truths. How important is it for you that a play's form does illuminate the content?
God, that's what Rufus Norris is always going on about, form and content, and content sort of leading you to your form and stuff. When you're actually writing, it's more that you want to... It sort of helps you, leads you to your ending, the form, and I can't really talk clearly about it. The form content thing, I can't really unpack that as a writer. I don't really sit down thinking about form and content. I kind of think about images and how they might serve what I'm trying to say in the play and land and make you bring something home deeply, you know.
So what were the other key images for you? What were the things that you were playing with while writing?
Well, I suppose the language thing of people saying I when they mean you, and then people saying you when they mean I. So Jake says, you don't fall in love with someone until you da 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 da. And I thought, yeah, he says you, but he means I. And it's about sort of putting things over there, isn't it? Away from yourself. And it's exactly the same with them saying, I raped. It's actually... No, I didn't. It's them. But it's like the little kid, and, you know, I kind of strewed all those crumbs all through the play of his son, who says, I didn't see myself doing that. That you kind of, he's his father's son. He puts some, he doesn't want to take responsibility. You know, the son, it's just, you know, I don't remember doing that. But then the father says, I look at the person I was when I got married, and I don't recognise myself, you know. So it's all about, I can't quite sort of tie it up with a bow, but it's about owning our actions, I suppose.
It seemed to me that the whole play throbs with this performative language. Right in the kind of act of what is consent? What is it to give consent? Consent is a sentence that changes something in the world by being spoken. But you talk about that in so many different, really, really fascinating ways. The idea that comes up several times in the play that by declaring your love, you can fall in love, you can increase your love, you can strengthen your love. There's an idea that the kind of act of sex, to make love, is to make love. And that seemed to me to kind of get really to the heart of what the law is, actually. The fact that these words, this strange, how many thousands of sentences add up to something in reality. Was that really, really useful for you as a dramatist, that you're dealing with this kind of active language?
Yes, it was. And I still feel like I didn't get all the things in that I wanted to about court cases, actually, because there's, I just find it fascinating that there are these testimonies that are so rambling and woolly, and they're in these voices that are, it's sort of the envy of any playwright, those transcripts, because it's how people actually speak about terrible things that have happened to them, and these weird moments of poetry in them, and yet they aren't poets, it's just they're saying what they felt, and then sometimes it's utterly bland about the most terrifying things, and that disjunct is really powerful as well. So there's one moment when the barrister Edwards says, and then I called him up, and that's what I did, yeah, I called him up, and I just wanted to get just a glimpse of this very RP voice saying this thing that was utterly not meant to be spoken in that voice.
It's interesting that idea of a kind of court transcript as being the data of language. The other thing that, one of the things that recurs in the play is this quality of phones, and phones that give criminals away, but also phones that give affairs away,
that kind of
keep tabs on you. How did that come into the play?
Because that was when I was thinking the rapists and the murderers of the middle class. I thought, look, here are these lawyers, they laugh at these slightly crap criminals who give themselves away with their phones, and yet we've all been caught out, you know, by our phone. So I thought this is the perfect marker to plant that you know, Edward thinks it'll never happen to him. He'll never be one of those thicko criminals that gets busted in that way. And then actually, you know, it's Kitty's phone that gives her away by having nothing in it. Actually, it's sort of there by absence.
Language is something that seems to occur in your plays. If you look at Tribes, it's this big focus on sign language, on communication, on in-jokes. If you go back to Rabbit, there's a character who's kind of losing his vocabulary. What is that as a fixation for you?
I suppose it's just because they are... It's what you're interested in. It's so pretentious, isn't it, to say, words, I love words. Isn't it in an Alan Bennett somewhere that I think it's in the History Boys that the teacher says that someone said, I love words, in a way that was Welsh. Vaguely Welsh. You're dealing with words and interested in words. So, you know, and they are... But then it's wonderful when you take them away, but you're using them in their absence, aren't you? They're there by not being there.
A lot of playwrights will tell you that they deal with action or motivation, and language is kind of just happens to be the vehicle for that.
Oh, really?
Yeah, okay. it feels to me like there's almost something quite unfashionable about plays that deal with language.
Oh, my goodness. I remember this director saying to me about Tribes, he said, Benina, what actually happens? Very little happens. And I thought, oh my God, you know, a boy leaves his family, a girl goes deaf, you know, so much happens. But I suppose a lot of it is verbal. No one actually knifes anyone or, you know, yeah.
There's a real density in a lot of your work. The layers of ideas and images kind of build up. I know Consent was sort of almost 10 years from commission to actual premiere. What's the process of building a play for you?
Well, it's sort of like, I think it's a bit like building a wasp's nest. You know how they look sort of earthy and there's loads and loads of little bits of paper and spittle and whatever that have made it. And I think it's like that. You pick up scraps day by day by day and you try to build this thing that in the end will have its own shape, and you won't, all of those little bits will disappear into this hole. The danger is, like, some reviews say, oh, the play's overstuffed, or you know, there's one too many themes going on or something. And it's terrible because I don't know, that's been a criticism many times, and I can't sort of deal with addressing it. It's the way I am, and I feel uncomfortable if I don't have all of those. I suppose they're like that magnet I was talking about earlier. They're different magnets to bring material to the play, and if I was just sort of, if I thinned it out, then I think I'd suddenly just have dialogue and nothing else, and that would make me uneasy, you know.
It makes for a very satisfying watch, I think, because one is always chasing it down and trying to connect things that may not connect for everyone, but you find your own juxtapositions and routes through in that complexity, that cloud of ideas.
Yeah. Well, my dad said, oh, it's amazing, you know, that there's this theme running through the play. He'd picked up on that you-I thing. And he said, it's a sort of duality. There's a dual narrative to everything in the play. The bird pretending to be the apple that the little kid draws. So it's not a bird and it's not an apple. It's the two things. And I thought, wow, I didn't even know that. When I wrote The Bird and the Apple, I think someone said it, and I thought, well, that's brilliant, that's so sophisticated for a child, and I just put it in. But it, you know, sometimes the patterns create their own, things fall into line, don't they?
It's very interesting. I mean, the amount of things, this is coming back to the density again, but reading it again the other day and kind of revisiting the first scenes, which when you're watching a play are just the first building blocks that are going in, you don't know how to decode them.
Yeah.
But going back to them and kind of seeing all those things that have been picked up by the end. The idea of children as the third party in a marriage often.
Yeah.
Or friends as the third party, but then sitting with judges. There are so many deft little points within it. There's a lovely series of about five lines, I think, where three characters give definitions of tragedy.
Oh, yes.
That adds up to being three different readings of Consent as a whole.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Well, but then you might get criticised for overstuffing. It's quite a fine line, isn't it?
Do you feel in control of plays when you're writing them?
No. No, not at all. You kind of, and then there are things that you just want to put in because they're hilarious, like the crackers that actually did happen, that someone had recycled crackers. But often those random things actually lift it out of just being too thematically driven, you know. I think I mean, going back to your question about, you know, this whole thing of metaphors and stage moments and the sheet, for instance. There's other things, like sometimes you just witness something in life and you think, I want to recreate that on stage, it's so electric. So for me, one scene that actually got cut was a court scene, and in this court scene someone is asked their name to confirm their name, which they always do at the beginning of those things. Are you Miss blah blah blah? Yes, I am. Do you have a brother called Mikey or whatever? Yes, I do. And I heard those questions being asked in a trial, and you don't know what the story's going to be, but the air was just crackling, you know, between the question and answer, these very bland, simple questions and answers. I thought, oh, that's, I've got to put that in a scene. And then it got cut, you know. But sometimes you just see things in life and you just want to try and recreate them on stage.
One of the things that's really interesting about the play is the sense of consenting to the law. That at the time, perhaps, you know, 4 months after Brexit, at a moment of real political division and class division, felt like a very, very pointed part of the play.
Yeah.
This sense of who is exempt from the law, who is defining the law, who is in control of the law, and who is subject to it. How did that emerge from the play? Because it doesn't sound like it was something that you set out to write about, and yet when it landed, it felt so...
I know, it's so weird. So the guy, Ben Chaplin, playing Edward, we were rehearsing that speech where he says, oh, I don't believe in argument anymore. I don't think people listen to argument. I think they just decide. And I wrote that pre-Trump, pre-Brexit, and I don't know. I suppose it's just that it's true, isn't it? And then it proved itself to be true. And I think it is terrifying. And I sat on a jury once, and it kind of boiled down to just impatience in the end, that they were like, well, he most likely did it, so come on. And I voted not guilty, because I thought, it's 9 years, it was a cocaine smuggling case, it's 9 years in jail, we better be sure, you know. But I think that often people are just emotional, impatient, and they kind of tell the law to fuck off, you know. They're in this jury room, and actually they can do what they want.
Tribes seem to be a similar thing, in that it landed in 2010 here, it premiered at a moment where generational divisions, baby boomers and boomerang kids in that play, felt very, very pertinent. Do you see yourself as a political playwright at all?
Oh God, I'd never claim to be that. No, I didn't even really read the papers until Brexit, and then I became completely addicted to reading The Times, The Guardian, The Telegraph, you know, everything online. But I could never be a James Graham, I don't think. It comes out of the people in a way. So I suppose if we're political because we live in the world, but I'd never feel confident about saying I was a political playwright.
And yet, at the same time, you are writing about these massive national institutions, the law, and the NHS with Tiger Country.
Yeah.
What's the appeal about them? It seems to me there's something about the individual and the institution.
Well, it's fantastic material, apart from anything. And you know, these are such high-stakes situations. But, yeah, it's also about how... What does it mean, these sort of really core questions? Like, by the end of the play, I sort of thought, why do we need the law apart from putting dangerous people in prison? Is it about needing to feel that someone... What is it... Why do we want people to be punished? And what does it mean to say sorry? I started reading stories about people meeting, you know, their murderers and rapists and things, and the release, the emotional release they got from that. And it's about... And I thought, this is so interesting. It's so important for somebody to say sorry for what they've done and to mean it. Then that kind of... It solves so much. And why is that? Yeah, so I suppose the law kind of was a way into that question that's not really the law, but an emotional one. And in the NHS, it was about... You know, how do we deal with mortality, I suppose. Yeah.
What drew you to writing for theatre in the first place? Why that art form?
Because I hate owning up to opinions. So it's a perfect way to air arguments and not have to say, but this is what I believe. You can hide. At the same time as sort of, you know, rehearsing all these different arguments, I suppose, because I did try writing prose, but you have to have such confidence, I think, to be a Tolstoy and say, Pierre felt that, you know, God, how do you know? I don't know. It's perverse. It's just the way that it's a great way to be shy, actually, is to be a playwright.
And yet,
your plays have a real sense of character and characters, I should say. What does it mean for you to write a person?
I think you've got to take from life, and then they start inventing themselves a bit. But I think again, that's about a lack of confidence. I feel very uneasy just sort of making someone up. I think you start with little sort of echoes of other people's voices and personalities, or even just a little thing that they said. Like, I was talking to someone, a very professional person, and I found out that they shoplifted. And I thought, oh my God. And actually, I really wanted to make one of the barristers a sort of inveterate shoplifter. I'm talking like little caramel bars in Pret. It was usually food, and this guy would just, you know, manage to, and he did it with such confidence, you know. And I thought, wouldn't it be great if Jake is a klepto like that? And that's sort of what about his affairs as well, that it's sort of, I want a chocolate bar on the side, you know. Anyway, it was cut because it just was too, one little curlicue too many. But that's an example of how, you know, I thought, oh, this is a great character thing. And it was totally, nothing else about this person was Jake, but it was just something that I wanted to import, you know.
What about handing those people on to actors?
That's just really fun, because then they add their own stuff in, and you know, then you've got someone like Ben Chaplin, who you're watching them, and there was this moment where he pulls the sheet off the sofa in the last scene, and he just looks at the sofa, and I said, it's so magic, that moment when you look at the sofa and I just see all those memories of your marriage. How do you do that? And he said, oh yeah, you just think the first time he shagged on that sofa, and you know, and he's just, you can sort of, his face is permeable, you can see it, you know, transparent or whatever.
You're a director as well as a writer. How do those two things sit together? Do they help? Do they hinder?
They help and they hinder. So it helps in that you can give actors a bit of a guiding hand without sort of squashing them, which I think some writers can be a bit tactless and just say, you need to do it faster, or, you know, whatever. It hinders in that it can close down your scope, because you can think, ugh, I don't want to set a scene on the Titanic and then the next scene is in a cafe, because that's just going to be a nightmare with sets, and you know, I don't want to do it with the light, and you start thinking all those unhelpful thoughts about lighting and sound cues, and you know, and then or also you can sort of think, oh, I can't write another character, that's another salary. And I come from Fringe, so I'm thinking that way even now, you know, about the cost of it. But then I think it can make you rigorous.
As your writing kind of goes forward, do you get more ambitious with it? What can we expect in 5 years' time from the next Nina Raine play?
Well, the next one I've written, and that is different because it's totally the opposite of all these things you've said about consent. It's not dense. It's very conversational, and it was very much from life. But my life, not other people's lives. So, and I wrote it very, very quickly, the quickest I've ever written a play. It was done in three months. And so I think the dialogue's different. And I don't think I'll ever write a play like that again. It was specific to the material I was using. So that's the next thing I've done.
So personal.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Theatre Voice is an audio archive about British theatre. You can subscribe to the weekly podcast on iTunes or visit our website, theatrevoice.com, to find hundreds of recordings with some of the world's leading theatre makers. This episode was hosted by Matt Truman and produced by Matt Truman and Helen Gush for the Victoria and Albert Museum in London. Thanks for listening.